You've all been super organized and be like, you know, this is what you kind of need to do. And I'm like, yeah, I've podcasted before. It's all good. It'll be fine. And I've turned up in like a disaster zone, like a literal disaster zone. But it's all good. I'm here. And that's all that matters.
Welcome to Cloud Realities, a conversation show exploring the practical and exciting alternate realities that can be unleashed through cloud-driven transformation. I'm Dave Chapman.
I'm Shao Kazal.
And I'm Rob Kernahan.
And this week we're going to explore product engineering. Now, product engineering as a subject and moving to product-based organizations is something organizations often think is really only the space of born in the cloud companies or digital companies, but actually there are a lot of complex organizations that are implementing these structures. We're going to examine that today and some of the challenges and opportunities that it can create. But before we get to that, I wandered into the office the other day just as Rob was finishing his new implemented daily stand-up. I think he was about to go into the third hour of his daily stand-up. And I wandered over to him and I'm like, Rob, what's going on? He's like, well, look, Dave, I'm really enthused by agile frameworks at the moment. And I thought I'm going to implement a daily stand-up wherein I can really dig into what's going on. So give me a minute and I'll tell you about what I'm confused about this week. So I said, okay, I'll just go and sit over there. Anyway, a couple of hours later, I got a chance to say, Rob, what are you confused about this week?
So David, love it, but you know, I'm not the best at paying attention for long periods of time, so I don't think that would work with my attention span.
I'm not suggesting you were consistent within that 4 hours, Rob.
Probably kept falling asleep halfway through it as well, and waking up again. Yeah, most likely, let's be honest.
Let's face it.
But this week, David, I am mainly confused about good intentions gone bad. And then how sometimes it auto-corrects itself and sometimes it doesn't. I think
we've all fallen over on auto-correct at times. I know I have.
But the one I'm going to call out is the cookie law. Born in the right ethos, but badly implemented. So data privacy, cookies are tracking us all over the internet. What do they do? Well, privacy law rises and says you have to have the right to control your cookies. So what happens, this really clunky implementation comes in, all the websites have an accept cookie button. You can manage your choices, but there's 2,000 items to go through, which basically means that, as we've talked about it before, people like convenience and everybody just clicks accept cookies. Yeah, which means that the law, with great intention, ended up not really achieving what do you want? And, you know, you're all out there, you all know, you've just gone, I can't be bothered, accept cookies, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened was the tech industry has looked at that problem space and has caught up. And if you look at what the Chrome engine's doing, you look what Apple and Android phones are doing, they're starting to implement new privacy systems where you set your preferences at the core, which is basically don't let anybody track me. And then the platform itself takes control of that. So the accept cookie button in the next 6 months will be redundant because the phone and the browser has completely deleted it. But I'm still confused about it took a long time for the tech companies to catch up with something that maybe the legislator should have thought about and said it's within the platform's right to control this, not each individual website, because it cost a huge amount of money to implement. And it ended up being a farce anyway. And actually, it was easier just to amend the platform. So confused about why that thinking wasn't done up front. Because I remember when the law came in, a lot of people said, why don't you just control this straight from a browser choice? And it's just default set and that's the end of it. So
isn't this just the classic case of, you know, well-meaning legislators,
exactly,
and governmental bodies, you know, even with the best will in the world, maybe not quite understanding the thing they're trying to legislate against. So they're probably understanding it from a point of view of your rights, whether it be your consumer rights, your human rights, whatever it might be. What concerns me about this is actually, it's probably less about the example you cite, though. You know, I'm ultra guilty of accepting all cookies that ever pop up in my browser. It is then what I'm signing up to in years to come, given the rise of the robots.
And your data's already out there and consumed, and the profiles have been made, and the big companies already know who you are and have done it. So I think we've passed the Rubicon as well. So we're trying to retrospectively install laws, but the data's the horse has bolted. You know, whatever analogy you like, the time for something like this was at the very beginning of when the big corps were forming.
Do you think it's completely unfixable now? We're so far past the Rubicon that actually the game's over.
I think you need to change your name, move house, and think about a new persona online if you want to just go. Yeah, it's all been collected and processed and gone.
I think you've resolved that problem, Rob, with a nice easy fix for everyone. So thanks for your time.
Good consumer advice again.
Okay, thanks. Exactly. Consumer advice. That's what they come here for. So, Rob, thanks for that. Now, I'm delighted to introduce our guest for today, who's going to help us work our way through the thorny subjects of product engineering. So I'm delighted to say that joining us is Steve Westgarth, Head of Product Engineering at Haleon. Steve, very nice to see you. Thanks for making the time to join us. Do you want to just say hello and introduce yourself?
So first of all, really good to be here. My name is Steve Westgarth. I'm the Global Head of Engineering and Architecture at Haleon. And I sit within a product organization within the organization where we look at how we can build products that drive better everyday consumer healthcare with humanity across the organization.
Right. Let's start, Steve, by talking about Haleon themselves. Very interesting company. Lots of things have happened over the last couple of years. Why don't you set the scene for us and just give us some background?
Sure. So Haleon is a consumer healthcare company. A couple of years ago, consumer healthcare was spun out of GSK. We were GSK Consumer Healthcare, and GSK had committed to float their consumer healthcare arm as a brand new limited company. So in July 2022, we separated from GSK, somewhere in the region of 20,000 staff operating out of 130-odd countries, selling products that you'll know every day. So things like Sensodyne, Voltarol, Centrum, all of those consumer healthcare brands that you're used to buying from your pharmacist are owned by Haleon. But the brand as a whole is brand new. 2 years ago, we didn't exist. So an $11 billion company born out of a huge pharma company that you will have heard of. But as a company ourselves, we're still establishing ourselves within the market.
Yeah, amazingly exciting opportunity. And what does that mean for IT? So given you described it interestingly there, has that allowed you to go in with sort of modern IT right from the outset, or are you still dealing with some legacy that's coming across from your parent company?
It's a really great question. So I think there are so many opportunities that we've had. I mean, so first of all, the separation was a huge challenge. So imagine a world where you have a multi-billion dollar company. You've got all of your systems set up, all of your HR, your payroll, your ERP, all of those core systems had to be separated and set up again from scratch in the new company. So that required us to have new vendor negotiations, required us to go and literally create and everything from day one as a new installation, new teams to support all those applications, new vendor relationships to support all those applications. And I mean, the undertaking really can't be understated in terms of how big a job that was for our tech teams and our tech organization. As a company, though, we approached that in a way which actually got us to a point where on day one of launch of Haleon, you know, compared to many other comparators you would look at that have separated in recent years, we had total separation of everything. Every system was our own, and we were running our own payroll. But a lot of that was replicated from what we had in GSK. You know, it was based upon a model that we knew worked and had understood. We had made some decisions along the way, things like you're needing to be cloud first and the relationship we have with Microsoft and you're wanting to move our workloads from physical data centers into the cloud was really important to us. So we did make some big decisions to allow us to do that. But even in that world, you were moving along where you didn't necessarily have the opportunity to create all of our applications in a cloud-native way. We might be using the cloud as effectively as a data center, but a lot of applications have been put into the cloud on VM technology or using not necessarily cloud-native technology. And that, I think, is a slightly longer-term opportunity for us as we kind of rationalize and see how we can better leverage the cloud to support what we're doing as a company.
I guess you find yourself there in an organizational state or an application landscape state that's actually a pretty common place to be, right? Where you've got stuff running on the cloud, but it might not be completely cloudified at that point. But you've actually got like an opportunity point forward to create a modernization agenda.
You do exactly that. And I think that that's also why engineering is so important at Haleon. So historically, GSK had outsourced lots of its engineering work to third-party vendors, and that had worked very effectively for the organization. But you're aware where some of our core technology, how it was being built and how it was being supported, and some of the decisions that have been made along the way to launch some of those systems, and to look at how we can build out in a state where you haven't got to think end-to-end every time somebody comes along with a new proposition. So
right.
I joined the organization as Global Head of Engineering in January 2022. That was about maybe 6 months before separation. And my remit there has been to really establish application engineering as a discipline within the organization, and to help the organization to understand how we can build out a modern product-aligned engineering practice, where we can move to a world where we can build APIs once, build them at scale, and then reuse them many times across different areas of the estate. So we spend a lot of time really maturing our API strategy and looking at how we can unlock data within the organization, but unlock it in a way that can be reused by many, many different applications. We're in a world where, and I guess this is applicable to a lot of companies, our core systems, you hold lots of our data, and it's kind of locked away. It's very difficult to integrate with. You know, there's lots of vendor lock-in with lots of our systems. And a lot of what we've been trying to do is to look at our estate and see how we can unlock that and allow us to be able to allow modern applications, new applications that we've built, to be able to get access to the customer data that's really going to drive our growth as we kind of move forward.
I think it's a really interesting scenario, because you have one of the big things that we talk about on the show a lot is that when you're pivoting an organization from legacy structures, which very common things that you're talking about, like data locked away, big vertical applications, outsourcing contracts and reskilling. So when you're pivoting that organization and just doing transformation without having, say, detached and created a new startup along the way, you're dealing with this huge cultural change. So it seems to me, I wonder how you'd reflect on that versus the journey that you're on, where you've inherited a lot of the technical aspect of the legacy problems, but presumably you've got a chance to sort of create new culture right from the outset.
We do. I mean, culture is so important as well. I mean, we're in a world where I would say across the digital and tech organization, 70% of staff within digital and tech are net new to Haleon, 30% obviously coming from GSK. So it's quite interesting, because GSK as a company is a pharma company, and that comes with different regulatory requirements to what a consumer healthcare company might have. And that opens up a new opportunity for us as a CPG to make different decisions about some of our governance processes, some of the things that we're operating, and how we're facilitating our operations and our software and technology build. So because we're in a world where we can leverage that opportunity, we have a lot of new people who have a lot of new ideas and want to mature the estate. And what we're now finding is you know, as an organization, we're unpicking how things have always been done around here and looking at how we can improve some of those processes, how we can become more efficient as an organization, how we can really drive business value as an organization by making things less complex. So I think there's definitely been a lot of thought given to how we can drive efficiency with the organization and how we can look to make better bang for our buck, if you like, with the investments that we're making. So we're really intelligently looking at how we can consolidate technology, how we can use things in multiple areas of the organization, how we can use fewer technologies in our tech stack so we've got your less things to support. So there's this rationalization exercise, it's actually, I think, a really healthy thing for the organization to do. And then from a software engineering point of view, it also makes sense, because, we're in a world where I've inherited hundreds of repos, and there are, literally tens of different languages have been used, you know, to build some of these applications. And from a maintenance point of view, you know, if I've got to support 30 or 40 different coding languages, it's very difficult to do that. You know, how can you possibly have the skills to cover that entire breadth within your organization? So we need to be more strategic about, you know, what tools, technologies, languages we're using to build some of these applications, while at the same time not stifling innovation and still giving our engineers the freedom of expression to leverage the latest, greatest tech, and also being aware that technology is constantly moving and we need to keep pace with where technology is at. And that's quite a difficult line to tread.
And I think you set up, if I understand it correctly, I think you set up like product domains that align to big sections of the business, but then you're managing product engineering as a tribe across the organization. Is that broadly in the right sort of place?
Yeah, that's definitely in the right ballpark. I mean, so I talk a lot about domain-driven design. And mm-hmm. you know, there are obviously different ways to skin this cat, and different organizations will do it in different ways. But if you think back to Eric Evans' book, which looks at how we can talk in the same language as our business, we have this concept of core domains. So core domains are the reason that we exist. They're how we're driving revenue in the organization. Core domains are the things that we're going to innovate in. You know, the things that are really going to differentiate Haleon. So those for me are candidates to make sure we've got really good in-house knowledge that is actively working on some of those product line streams, aligned to our business strategy. You know, the business is very interested in how we talk about some of those technologies and what we're doing and the outcomes that we're delivering. I then talk about generic subdomains. So a generic subdomain is something which is a solved problem. So think about content management, for example. Now, Haleon should never, I would argue, be in a position where we're going to build a content management system. That would be a ridiculous thing to do. There are so many content management systems out there you would buy off the shelf. Really important that it integrates well with our ecosystem. So we're really interested in Mac architecture. We're talking about something which is composable, API first, API driven, probably with some sort of eventing solution so we can start pushing content to services and doing all of those sorts of things. But still, something which we're going to buy off the shelf, it's a solved problem, a PaaS service that we're going to integrate. And then you've got this idea of supporting subdomains. So this is where we know there's some integration that's needed. It's probably a solved problem. Lots of people have done it before, but it's not our USP. It's not where we're innovating. So a good example of that might be payments, for example. So everybody takes payments. There's a lot of different payment providers out there. You need to integrate back into your estate, back into your ERP, and do all of those things. But again, it's something that potentially is a really good space for our partner ecosystem to operate in. So we start to say, well, because we're in an API ecosystem, that's kind of where we're building, we want to be creating, maybe a way to describe this would be almost kind of your internal software as a service products. So and those products are effectively capabilities. So think about capabilities as things like payments or analytics or order management or transaction management. Those bounded contexts, they might be leveraging PaaS services, generic subdomains that we've bought off the shelf. They might be integrated into the estate. But the concept here is that when an engineer or a product line team comes along, they should be able to pick and choose these composable services they want to use and then reuse those within their application. Mm-hmm. So think about, if you take a different context other than Haleon, think about something like payments, if you were going to integrate PayPal. So I would go to developer.paypal.com and very quickly I could integrate PayPal into my site because they've given me some sample code. There's some really great documentation. And you simply include that into your React app and suddenly half an hour later, there I've got payments kind of being taken. I see that as very similar for our capabilities internally. So we have this model where you can pick and choose the capabilities you want. And we've standardized around backstage.io to give really good internal visibility and discoverability of our APIs and services with some really good documentation that engineers can use. Mm-hmm. And the idea is people can pick and choose all of these applications. We've written some internal SDKs that are able to be used. And you can leverage that as part of your application. And although we're only 2 years into this journey, but I think so far that approach is really starting to pay dividends because that's where we're really starting to drive the reuse. So if you take the order management capability, for example, we've done one integration with SAP and we don't need to integrate, we don't need to integrate again for all the other use cases that we've got.
Cool. I'm interested in, I think, two levels of how that whole ecosystem is performing. I think the first from a point of view of the consuming business. So how is it feeling to the consuming business? Do they feel like they are now feeling intimate with that process and feeling like they've got like a new innovation speed that they've been looking for? And then just to get it all on the table, the second element is for one of the developers within that ecosystem, how do you feel like it's functioning, and are you functioning yet at the sort of tick speed that you want to be running at?
Definitely. So I think from our business's point of view, it definitely has had an impact on how quickly we can achieve some of the things that we've been trying to achieve. Mm. And although this you're right now isn't in every area of our business, you know, it's still a journey we're kind of going on to. I think where we've seen your success, I think, you know, it's definitely seen some radical improvement in speed to market. And, you know, you've come along and you've been able to do something within, you know, a couple of months that's actually achieved what we want to achieve. So, you know, it really has had a massive impact where we've been able to leverage these sorts of techniques with our business, which I think is really having a tangible difference.
And when you've done this massive transformation, you've greatly improved agility, very progressive engineering thought process linking with the business, creating very high performing teams. Do you ever go back to your GSK colleagues where you came from and you split from? And I know they're a more regulated area, but do you compare notes on the successes you had and share strategy and see if there's something that can benefit both? Is that a conversation you've sustained? Because you've done an awful lot to transform the way IT delivers to the business very successfully. So I was just wondering if there's still a compare notes process that goes on.
So we are now a separate company. So I joined Hayley on 6 months before separation. So I haven't really got deep rooted contacts back within GSK. So although there has definitely been conversations, and obviously your GSK is still, you're a good friend of Hayley on, and will remain so. I wouldn't say that we're actively comparing notes on approach. What I would say is though that as a tech leader, I get involved with a lot of peers and colleagues and other organizations and do evangelize a lot about this approach that we're going to take. And even the fact that I'm doing this podcast with you today,
yeah,
you know, I talk a lot about some of the benefits that this has driven and the community it kind of brings. And I do talk a lot about, you know, where many of us are in non-competing industries, and, you know, a lot of the problems we're trying to solve here are common across lots of different types of organizations. And I think there's two things that I think I've learned as I've kind of went through my career and kind of you experiment with some of these things. The first is the importance of having long-lived squads, regardless of how you're funding something, but people that know your organization, you're working with you, you're for the long term, is critical. And I don't care whether those people are internal people or whether they come from a partner organization, however you're choosing to resource and to scale up your engineering team, that doesn't really matter. But the importance is continuity, because you actually, by building that, you build so much knowledge inside your teams, and actually where you lose velocity and where you lose time is when you're between programs and between projects, when something spins down and something else spins up, you know, that knowledge which is lost, it's really intangible, and I don't think people really appreciate how significant that is to an engineering organization. So long-lived teams is the first thing that I would say is super important. And actually within that, you know, what I've also found very effective is, you know, you're taking work to the team. So even if I've got multiple initiatives that might be funded in all sorts of different ways, it doesn't matter whether those initiatives are kind of planning, you know, milestones over a period of time or kind of whatever that might be. It doesn't matter about the methodology you're adopting for the project, but driving the work into the team that has the knowledge, you know, rather than trying to orientate a new team around a problem is incredibly important. I think that's, you know, that's something that organizations must get.
And this is one of the beauties of products, which is they're aligned to the business. They can have that intimacy. They need to not only survive, but thrive, but it allows that longevity of relationship to be established, as opposed to, say, a more mutualized service where the same request can ping about the organization through multiple layers, get lost and get confused. So it is, I mean, I'm a massive advocate of the product-based organization, but exactly to your point, it allows the type of ethos that you're talking about to be realized more easily. But it requires the funding lines to be affected. It requires a lot of change within an org to make sure that the product can thrive.
So I think there are a couple of different archetypes that we have. So Archetype one is the true product organization. So you're against my bounded context of domains, you're where you have a team that is iterating against a product backlog, and that's a long-lived thing that we're trying to deliver for the team. This website, this e-commerce destination, whatever it might be that we're iterating and developing on, that's aligned to a value stream in the business. So that's one archetype. The other archetype of engineering we've got is what I would term continuous delivery. And this is where you've got ad hoc demand of things in our business where somebody has come along and said, hey, I need to make a change to this. Hey, I've got this request to automate that. You know, hey, I just need to do this because it's going to enable something for what I'm kind of doing. When we have that sort of demand, we have this concept of continuous delivery teams. It's still working in a product-aligned way. They still have a backlog. They still have a roadmap that's built out for them. But that demand is very much skill set based. So I have some JavaScript engineers. I've got some platform engineers. I've got some skill sets that are maybe API engineers, whatever it might be, and you're driving that demand to a team that has the right skills to do it. And I think that's another archetype that works quite well. And in both of those scenarios, actually, I mean, the funding, yes, it's important, but you know, many people, your companies will work with programs and initiatives. Well, I work with programs and initiatives in terms of where they work, right? It's very much an agency model, if you like. You know, it's no different to me setting up a business that was a software development house and selling my services that way to multiple different businesses. And by thinking differently like that and thinking around how you can, without having to change all of your internal processes and change how you're funding all of your projects and programs and initiatives, you can actually kind of meet your finance teams halfway and realize that to be agile, you don't necessarily need to have, rewritten the way we do everything around here. You can adapt and make that work, which in its nature is being agile, right?
So there's a lot said. You used the big A word in that answer there, and it felt like maybe is to bring today's conversation to a little bit of a conclusion. It barely feels like we've scratched the surface. I just want to talk to you about agile, and it's a well-worn path.
So I'm all about driving autonomy to the teams. I mean, this is a big agile principle. How do you make your autonomous teams that are able to make independent decisions? Now, in command and control management structures, where you've got people who need updates and all those things, it's actually quite difficult, to let go of control and give the team autonomy. But one of the things we do, every 6 weeks, each team comes in with their leadership, so the product owner, the engineering manager, the principal engineer, and we have a health check. And they have they're required to prepare some content, tell us what's going well in the team, what our achievements are, what team changes have got, what our challenges are, what management intervention and what management support that they need. And you actually find that because you've given that accountability to the engineers, certainly in my experience, they embrace that and they go, this is brilliant, because actually we've got total control of our own world. We can change what we want in our world, and that's all good. The things we can't change, the things you're outside of our control, I've now got a mechanism by which people are genuinely interested in helping my team to get better. So to bring that kind of around, I mean, there are so many topics in the space that I can talk about, but I think organizations need to stop talking about frameworks. I think that's not where we're going. I think we need to be talking truly about what drives true business agility. And the thing which does that is your product line teams, your teams that are the same individual, so you aren't spinning up and spinning down teams according to work, and moving to a world where teams are able to work with as much autonomy as you possibly can and as few dependencies as you possibly can. And linking that back to the domain-driven design stuff with bounded contexts, that's a really great way of trying to move to a world where you haven't got as many dependencies between teams that enables them to really kind of push forward.
Shalk, what have you been looking at this week?
So each week I do some research on related ideas in transformation and tech, and this week I thought we should take a look at the 5 key characteristics of high-performing teams. So high-performing teams consistently meet their goals, work cohesively as a unit, and are engaged in their work. So what makes a high-performing team so successful? First, trust is essential for teams to reach their full potential. Clear communication. Clearly defined roles prevent conflicts and boost productivity. Engaged leaders provide direction without micromanaging. And lastly, collective goals ensure that individual contributions align with the team's overall success. So a question, are these the most important elements of high-performing teams?
So that's a very interesting list. I think there's two very key things for me that we need to think about. First is purpose, and maybe that goes to the goal point. People with a purpose are better at creating something, especially when it's a purpose they're passionate about. And that's not increase shareholder value. That's create a new experience or something special or help the citizen out or the consumer or whatever. I think the second point is they all come together to make happiness, and happy people are naturally more productive. Mm. So I think purpose and happiness and leadership focusing on creating purpose that isn't some moronic business concept, and also the happiness that goes with it.
We've made a podcast out of moronic business concept, bro. Come on.
Yeah. But that sort of just focus on the numbers bit doesn't motivate the average person to go and do something great. So you got that bit, and then you've got the general happiness of the environment. And we talk about psychological safety in there, trust is a big part about that. But without those underlying facets, all the things that you talk about, I think maybe don't work as well. So I think there's some foundations for success that I would maybe layer in around those to say, if you don't have those, you don't get the other things that you talk about.
I was going to raise psychological safety. I think it's like an imperative in those sorts of environments, because one of the things that high performing teams do way better than low performing teams is the level of challenge that's involved. And you're challenging each other the whole time to improve what you're doing, whether that's a digital product or whether that's, you know, kind of any type of work, frankly, just doesn't really matter. But you can't have edgy challenge without a level of psychological safety in the team, it feels like to me. The other thing I observe, which is a bit around the boundaries of the list that you had, which is, as you read it out, people might have been listening and, you know, I had half an ear on. Oh, it was all quite obvious. It's like, well, of course you should have a clear reason to do this. And of course you should measure things. And of course you should do this. But it's funny how many teams don't do it.
Yeah.
And you got to, that's the big question for me, which is like, it's worth taking a step back and looking at even how kind of your team functions at the moment or whatever it is, and just go, actually, have I got the basics of clean lines in place here before you even get to the more complex stuff, you know?
Absolutely. I think, Steve, when you were closing, your point is don't focus on frameworks, but focus on driving autonomy and empowerment so that people can do the right thing well. And I think that motivates people a lot when they're given the freedom to be able to build what they know they need to build and do. Everybody comes to work to do the right thing, yeah? So give them the environment that allows them to do what they need to do.
And on that psychological safety point, so just going back to the thing I was talking about with health checks, there's a really good example of this a few weeks ago where we went into a health check and we have a team scorecard where I kind of do various metrics and kind of things that kind of goes out once a quarter. And in this particular thing, there's a team that looks after enterprise search for us, and they're measured really on, it's the number of users of enterprise search. And one of the things we're trying to do is to drive more users of search. So I made an independent decision, you know, where you know we'd had a stagnant three quarters of your not increased usage, and actually in some cases a decline in the use of enterprise search. And I downgraded it from a green to an amber RAG rating. And we went into this team health check, and the principal engineer came in and he was like, yeah, we just wanted to have a conversation about, you know, the scorecard. You know, the team was really disappointed that we were downgraded from a green to an amber, and we didn't understand why it happened. And I jumped off the back of that and was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. I'm so sorry. I should have went into the team and had a conversation with you before we made that decision to explain to you why we were going from green to amber and to help you kind of go through that. But it made me realize that actually, you know, as a leader, you're leading agile teams. You know, you make all these autonomous decisions and kind of things, but that can have a massive impact on the psychological safety within the team. You know, if I hadn't had that health check opportunity where I'm kind of going into the team and, you know, and the team has the opportunity and are encouraged to challenge me, I thought it was a really healthy thing for the team to call me out on it, because they were absolutely spot on. You know, I should have absolutely had that conversation first. But, you know, how many times do you have this thing where leadership's made a decision and something's happened, the team doesn't understand what it is, and because you've got that disconnect, you know, that definitely damages the psychological safety of the teams. So I think this comes to, you know, open and good communication lines with the teams, understanding what the team challenges is, and the importance of leadership, of having personal relationships with the people in the team so that they're aware that they can, you know, they can have a robust conversation with you and call you out if something that you've done, you know, isn't the right thing to have done.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, a great conversation this afternoon. Lots of room in that to explore more deeply, but it's been a brilliant insight into the challenges of creating agile, both big and small, product engineering teams in complex organizations. So Steve, thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Our pleasure. So we end every episode of this podcast by asking our guests what they're excited about doing next. And that might be, I've got a great restaurant, or I'm doing something exciting at the weekend, or it could be something in your professional life. So Steve, what are you excited about doing next?
I've come up to Leeds today. So I'm normally based in Chester, and actually it's been interesting kind of as we started kind of getting set for this podcast, making all of my tech work in a different location. Yeah. But I've come up because I'm going to a very good friend's 50th birthday, who has a surprise party tonight. So I'm off out for that, which is going to be great. And then heading back to Chester, on Saturday at some point. So really excited for that.
That sounds great. A couple of things. First of all, this will go out well after your friend's surprise birthday party.
So you haven't just spoiled it. We're not releasing now.
No risk there on spoiling that, which is good for everybody, I think. But also, yeah, the arrangements of having to record this over a 5G phone has been podcasting on a knife edge, I think I would refer to it as.
Dangerous podcasting.
It is indeed.
We should have had danger music going on in the background as we were doing it.
Podcasting on the edge.
It's been like a tightrope walk. So thanks for bearing with us, Steve. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
So a huge thanks to our guest this week. Steve, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks also to our sound and editing wizards, Ben and Louis, our echoing producer, Marcel, and of course, to all of our listeners. We're on LinkedIn and X, Dave Chapman, Rob Kernahan, and Xiao Kizal. Feel free to follow or connect with us, and please get in touch if you have any comments or ideas for the show. And of course, if you haven't already done that, rate and subscribe to our podcast. See you in another reality next week.